Mother Nature, Mother Nature, she's gonna get you. Yeah, she's gonna get you. Mother Nature, she's grown to hate you. She's gonna get you. Gonna get you, you betcha.
Network. It's NBL on PRN.FM. God, I love that theme song. This is June 7, 2016 edition, episode 93 of Nature Bats Blast. Comes to you live from the Mud Hut in southern New Mexico with myself, Mike Sliva, and the good doctor guy, McPherson. Our thanks to Aphrazin for his theme song contribution. You can find more of his work on SoundCloud.com. This is also a call-out show, or suggested by Mark. It's a laugh-out show, so today we'll take calls. And we're going to talk about the educational industrial complex, which Guy and I are both really familiar with.
Quite
familiar with. And our studio audience of zero, which also reflects our dropping ratings as well, our numbers.
I'd say so.
Not only are our numbers falling,
we can't even get anybody to sit in the audience.
We can't even get people to show up at a house anymore.
Yeah, well, I need you to stand out on the road with one of those signs. Come in here.
Yeah, we'll work for radio.
I've been telling you for years, I got a great face for radio, and finally people are starting to figure it out.
There we go. All right, so we'll start with an explanation of what we're trying to accomplish with this particular show with the industrial, or the educational industrial complex, and in other upcoming episodes when we have call-out shows. We've been using this format once each month. We started 6 months ago with an episode focused on Michael Mann and his work. We followed up with critiques of Catherine Hayhoe, Naomi Klein, Bill McKibben, the non-profit industrial complex, and last month, celebrity culture. In every case invoking individuals, we've informed the person in advance of our motives and asked them to join us on the show, and then to rub it in just a little. We sent them the link of the show after it aired. We've been joined on these shows by independent journalist Corey Morningstar. Unfortunately, Corey is unable to join us for this week's show. Today, we'll continue our efforts to dig below the surface, as with recent critiques.
So now Corey won't even join us?
No, we can't even get Corey to show up anymore.
We've never even met her.
But I don't know if you noticed, but our Podbean numbers are going down. So
yeah, not going down. Looking like a comet.
Yeah, I don't know what's going on with Podbean. Clearly, it's not us.
I need to remind you what is the dinosaur's least favorite reindeer?
The dinosaur's
Comet,
oh.
Sorry, I thought that was fun.
Pretty good. Now I lost my spot in the script. Great. As with recent critiques, we'll concentrate on the entire sector, the educational industrial complex. We complain about mainstream media being bought by special interest groups like those who run the fossil fuel industry. We rarely complain when our experts are tied to an institution, organization, business, or even a paycheck. The fact that someone is giving them a paycheck should be a red flag. Not everyone gets a paycheck. I don't. Guy doesn't. Corey doesn't. In fact, none of the major contributors to Nature Bats Blast and Progressive Radio Network receive a paycheck. We are not on the payroll at PRN, nor have we ever been asked to edit or censor our content. There are no sponsors on PRN. We are not governed by the FCC. We can say whatever we want, whenever we fucking want to say it. Today we continue our series of episodes focused on public figures and institutions who have major voices and the culture in which they and we are embedded. This week's conversation goes beyond individuals, but still focuses on the primary source of news for most people. These people and groups are vital to the flow of information heard by most people. We are not saying they all have been bought. We are saying they are censored, whether it be by the institution or organization they work for, or self-censorship in response to potential actions taken against them. They are paid. We are not.
Can we make that point over and over again? We are not.
We are poor. Well, I'm poor, but we don't get any money. With this episode, we highly encourage anyone who receives significant airtime on major media outlets to become free agents. We know, of course, this will never happen. This isn't to say that you can't have a job or make an income. We are, however, saying that if you are a leading voice in environmental protection, social justice, or climate science, your voice and your word are suspect.
I remember when you were the upbeat guy, the optimistic guy.
Yeah.
What happened to those days?
I watched the Tomorrowland. Which we can talk about later. There is no Tomorrowland. In order to become a trusted member of Information Exchange, a sacrifice is required. Actually, it only feels like a sacrifice until you've taken the steps we have taken. Leaving the institution or organization that pays you will set you free, believe it or not, and also gives the public a reliable voice. We here at MBL are not well-known or leading voices in the mainstream media, yet we have taken steps to be considered reliable voices. Please join us in supporting those who must take such a step. The echo chamber must become quiet. So while our listeners are getting ready with questions, we'll start off with an update on climate change. Guy, what do you have for us?
Well, first of all, that number, that toll-free number to call us with your questions is 888-874-4888. That'll connect you to the studio. They'll connect you with us. I do have a few updates on the climate change front. First, as I reported earlier, a paper in the February 3rd, 2016 issue of Nature found a long-sought smoking gun with respect to carbon storage in the deep ocean. Well, as it turns out, carbon was stored in the depths of the Southern Ocean when atmospheric carbon dioxide levels were quite low. Further confirmation was published in the May 9, 2016 issue of Nature Communications. I'll summarize from the paper. In the past 800,000 years of climate history, the transitions from interglacials and ice ages were always accompanied by a significant reduction in the carbon dioxide content in the atmosphere. It then fell from 280 to 180 parts per million. Where this large amount of carbon dioxide went to, and the processes through which the greenhouse gas reached the atmosphere again, has been controversial. This recent paper reports a major carbon dioxide reservoir at a depth of 2,000 to 4,300 meters in the South Pacific, and it reconstructs the details of its gas emission history. Again, that's the May 9, 2016 issue of Nature Communications. Second update also requires a bit of context. The March 16, 2015 online issue of Nature Geoscience identified melting from below with respect to the Totten Glacier on Antarctica. Now, though, a paper published in the May 19, 2016 of issue of Nature finds the Totten Glacier capable of, quote, repeated large-scale retreat and advance, end quote. Yeah, with the researchers concluding in an interview with the Washington Post that the glacier is, quote, fundamentally unstable. And that's not a good thing, even if you prefer warm water.
And take a drink.
An op-ed piece in the May 19, 2016 issue of The Guardian is headlined, Climate Scientists Mourning Earth Losses Should Make Their Voices Heard. It was penned by Sarah Meir, who calls herself, quote, an ocean and climate scientist with expertise in the marine ecological consequences of abrupt climate warming, end quote. In this article, she writes, we scientists are the gatekeepers of the basic information that fuels decision-making by nations, businesses, and communities. We are so skilled at many, many detailed and quantitative tasks, but as you would expect from a community of introverts, we are not great at shining that brilliant light back on ourselves.
That's the call-out show.
I have so many things I want to say. I could take the whole rest of the hour commenting on that one sentence. She goes on, the problem is we are past the threshold. We are just playing games with ourselves. In the anticipation of it, it has passed silently underneath our feet. We are already committed to a world that is warmer and more dangerous than the world of my grandmother's childhood. That world where we had time, we didn't have to be political, we took only small calculated risks, has evaporated in front of us. So why are we still operating under old rules?
Good question.
Yeah. One reason may be that scientists are naturally risk-averse where it comes to public dialogue. Towards the end of the article, she concludes with this paragraph. I believe most scientists are also quietly and professionally mourning the loss of the balance of Earth's life. The pain doesn't stop. It's carried upon every wildfire, coral bleaching, or marine die-off. But we can use these waves of pain to inform our moral commitment to the present and future. It requires the brave integration of science and self, the acceptance of loss, end quote. Well, maybe, and maybe not. I don't see anybody within the Matrix calling for termination of the heat engine of civilization. And I see a lot of calls for should this and should that, but very little mention of the evidence underlying near-term human extinction.
I was just impressed she actually used the word acceptance.
Yeah.
Hey, that's a big step.
We have a caller.
Oh, we have a caller.
Should we take him? Antonio from North Carolina?
Sure.
Go on.
Yeah,
no. Okay, Antonio, what
Hi.
You got?
Guy, Mike, how you
hey.
Doing? Can you guys hear me?
Yeah.
Fire away.
Over the last 10 years or so, I've been sort of waking up to the actual realities around me, and as I've waded through all sorts of corporate and alternative media, what I finally come to the conclusion of is the one thing I look for the most is people that I think are actually trying to be honest. Doesn't mean they're correct. They're just trying to be honest. So I really appreciate you guys, because I definitely feel that you guys actually try to be honest.
Well, thank you. We appreciate that.
Thank you.
Secondly, I've been trying to call in when Corey was there because she's investigative journalist badass, and I've been trying to find something to add to the conversation that she brings out through Wrong Kind of Green. And I finally found the thing, and unfortunately she's not on, but I can share it with you guys if you want.
Sure, absolutely.
So apparently back in April, Barbara Boxer, liberal-flavored senator from California, and Dick Durbin, barely liberal-flavored senator from Illinois, tried to introduce legislation to create climate change bonds. So Barbara Boxer was talking about how much she loved, as a little kid, paying for war bonds to support the war effort. And so now they think it'd be a great idea and excite kids if they were to buy climate change bonds to support, I guess, the war on the ecosystem. I'm not sure.
Yeah, I think you said that right, actually.
And on top of that, just to put it into what Corey talks about, is that the fund will be managed by none other than the Secretary of Commerce.
You're making
so
this up.
You know, they don't even pretend it's the EPA or anything like that. It's Commerce.
Commerce. That's the best.
I didn't know The Onion was published in North Carolina.
Yeah, indeed. To finally add to this, Corey often talks about how the new economy, one of the things that's so twisted about how they present it, is that not only are they going to make us have it, take it, but they're going to act, make us demand it. As the people, we're going to say, no, you have to give us this new economy. It kind of struck me as exactly that chord, with the idea that not only would we pay for it anyway through subsidies and everything else, but they're going to actively make us want to give our money directly to it.
Yeah, well, they're making us beg for fascism right now.
Right now, right.
And we are.
Yeah. And we do love
them. It just seems so crazy blatant, but I guess it all seems that way at this point.
Oh. Thanks for brightening our day, Antonio.
Well, thank you. That's pretty much all I kind of wanted to mention. But you guys had mentioned if you are having dropping viewer stuff, when you guys announced that you would be reducing your show to once a month,
yeah.
I think that could have a temporary impact, just the way people's psyches work.
That's a good point, because exactly when we announced that is exactly when our numbers started to drop.
To me, that makes sense. I think certain people think, like, oh, my God, even they're giving up. And so, you know, maybe listenership will slow down a little bit. But at some point, I think for most of us that are paying attention to this level, the itch comes back. Every now and then you just need a break.
Absolutely, no doubt. And that's really kind of why we're going to once a month for a while. We're going to be traveling and things like that. And it's a good break. It'll give us a new fresh start and kind of mess around with the format a little. So.
Well, I think it's a great idea. So I hope it goes great, and I will continue to listen. If I get any other interesting tidbits, I'll call in again.
Excellent. Great call. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. That may be the best call we've ever got.
Yes,
as far as,
could be.
You know.
Yeah. Send us your address by email, Antonio, and yeah, we'll send you some charming little gift.
Right.
I mean, it won't be worth anything.
No, it could be a pipe bomb. I'm kidding.
It'll be a surprise.
We love you.
Whatever it is.
No, that was great. I mean,
yeah,
he was organized. He had
points. Okay, so let's have a contest right now. Anybody who calls in has to beat that.
Oh, good.
Huh? If you can't beat that, just shut up. No, that's not what I meant.
Paul Marcon may be able to beat that.
Paul, are you out there?
All right.
Okay. Next little update on the climate front.
Right.
According to a report released May 20th, 2016, by the United Nations Environment Program, toxic crops and zoonotic diseases. And what you say are zoonotic diseases? Those are the ones that are passed from non-human animals to humans. Actually, the report says from animals to humans.
Can you get them at the zoo?
Of course you can.
All right.
But, of course, humans are animals, too, so I just wanted to confirm that. Okay, so toxic crops and zoonotic diseases are among the leading environmental issues of our time, and they're exacerbated by climate change. I'll quote from the article at Yale 360. As extreme weather increases in frequency and intensity, food crops are producing more chemical compounds that can be toxic to humans in large doses, according to a recent report by the United Nations Environment Program. Crops such as wheat, maize, and soybeans generate these compounds as a natural response to environmental stressors such as droughts, floods, or heat waves. But when consumed by humans for extended periods of time, they can cause illnesses like neurological diseases or cancer, according to the study. And, of course, we've been consuming these grains, which are the basis of civilization, for a few thousand years now. So, of course, these things are starting to show up.
Bummer.
Oh, well.
Yeah.
You knew you were going to die anyway.
Yeah.
The May 27th, 2016 issue of Manga Bay includes this headline, quote, "Scientists puzzled by slowing of Atlantic conveyor belt warn of abrupt climate change." I could go off again. But I'll try to focus. The paper refers to a recent write-up in the May 13, 2016 issue of Science by Eric Hand titled "New Scrutiny for a Slowing Atlantic Conveyor." It seems most oceanographers, like most other scientists, are still puzzled and are still warning about the future that's already here. Allow me an example. Through the first 265 years of the Industrial Revolution until September 2015, the global average temperature of Earth increased 1 degree Celsius. And in the following 4 months, the temperature increased more than half a degree Celsius, in addition to the additional 1C. Abrupt climate change is here. I'm not puzzled.
Wait. I don't get it.
We won't let you call
that. That was me being nice. All right. Back to the topic of today's show, the educational industrial complex. Guy and I are products of the public education system in the United States, and we taught at various institutions in this country, lacking callers on the line so far,
except for
one,
Antonio,
which was a very good call.
It was awesome, which almost makes up for the fact that none of the rest of you are calling.
Right. Maybe you can send him some cool, like, trinket or something.
A trinket?
Something made from plastic.
We've got that.
Right. So let's start with a historical context concerning the educational industrial complex from Guy.
Okay. Thanks, Mike. I'll start us off by reading a long passage from my 2006 book. 2006. That was a long time ago.
You didn't help that.
Letters to a Young Academic. I posted this excerpt on the blog 5 years later and 5 years ago. The entire system of public education in the United States was designed specifically to prevent students from thinking for themselves. That's a pretty strong assertion, so I will review the evidence that supports it. In an earlier letter, and here I'm referring to an earlier letter in this book, Letters to a Young Academic, I quoted Jules Henry's book, Culture Against Man. Quote, "School is indeed a training for later life, not because it teaches the three R's, more or less, but because it instills the essential cultural nightmare, fear of failure, envy of success, and absurdity." Henry reached this conclusion after spending hundreds of hours in the classrooms of our public school system and reviewing a mountain of published evidence. His scathing critique of American culture strongly supports the notion that individuality and creativity are purposely eviscerated from students well before they complete high school. The roots of the cultural crisis run much deeper than the countercultural days of the 1960s, when Henry was writing, and well beyond the sphere of education. But education has long been fundamental to the destruction of individuality, creativity, and, for lack of a better word, soul. Consider, for example, a few words in a speech. to Businessmen by President Woodrow Wilson. Quote, "We want one class to have a liberal education. We want another class, a very much larger class of necessity, to forego the privilege of a liberal education and fit themselves to perform specific difficult manual tasks," end quote. Wilson's sentiments echoed those of William Torrey Harris in his 1906 book, The Philosophy of Education, in which he writes, 99 students out of 100 are automata, careful to walk in prescribed paths, careful to follow the prescribed custom. This is not an accident, but the result of substantial education, which, scientifically defined, is the subsumption of the individual, end quote. In vogue with his time, Harris extended the idea of subsumption to the land as well as the individual. Quote, "The great purpose of school can be realized better in dark, airless, ugly places. It is to master the physical self, to transcend the beauty of nature," end quote. As I indicated in previous correspondence, Harris was the U.S. Commissioner of Education from 1899 to 1906.
Of course he was.
Harris was not the only influential educator willing to express his desire for docile American citizens during that year, 1906. That year, the Rockefeller Education Board,
we know them.
If we had a live studio audience, they would boo and hiss when I said those words. That same year, the Rockefeller Education Board, a major advocate of compulsory public education, issued this statement, quote, "In our dreams, people yield themselves with perfect docility to our molding hands. The present educational conventions, intellectual and character education, fade from our minds, and unhampered by tradition, we work our own goodwill upon a grateful and responsive folk. We shall not try to make these people or any of their children into philosophers or men of learning or men of science. We have not to raise up from among them authors, educators, poets, or men of letters. We shall not search for embryo great artists, painters, musicians, nor lawyers, doctors, preachers, politicians, statesmen, of whom we have ample supply. The task we set before ourselves is very simple. We will organize children and teach them to do in a perfect way the things their fathers and mothers are doing in an imperfect way," end quote.
Yeah.
The statement by the Rockefeller Education Board and the book by Harris were preceded a year earlier by Elwood Cumberley's dissertation at Columbia Teachers College. The future dean of education at Stanford University wrote the school should be factories, quote, "in which raw products, children, are to be shaped and formed into finished products, manufactured like nails, and the specification for manufacturing will come from government and industry," end quote.
These people were like Trump before Trump.
Yeah. And they're putting it right out there in the open.
Yeah. Well, that's the thing. I mean, it's not any different. We literally on this show expose what's out in the open ourselves,
right,
in a different way.
Right.
And people are like,
but if we start right now,
I may change bonds or whatever.
Right, right, right. Okay, tracing these ideas further back in time, we find the 1888 report of the Senate Committee on Education. This is the United States Senate Committee,
right,
on Education, a summary of which is provided by a single sentence on page 1382 of this gargantuan document. Quote, "We believe that education is one of the principal causes of discontent of late years manifesting itself among the laboring classes." I'm going to reread that.
Too long for a T-shirt.
"We believe that education is one of the principal causes of discontent manifesting itself among the laboring classes. According to John Taylor Gatto, award-winning educator and author of the 1992 book Dumbing Us Down, the committee was justifiably nervous about the high quality of education provided by non-standardized local schools where students were actually taught to think for themselves. The Senate report parallels the 1897 writings of famous philosopher and industrial educator John Dewey. Dewey's famous pedagogic creed, first published in the school journal, included this thought about the role of teachers in society. Quote, I believe that every teacher should realize he is a social servant set apart for the maintenance of the proper social order and the securing of the right social growth, end quote. Cumberley provided the proper social order and the right social growth less than a decade after Dewey and the U.S. Senate supplied the rationale for hurting the masses on behalf of business.
Yeah, so when we talk about, as former teachers, when we question current teachers, we often get a lot of pushback. Well, and mainly because the narrative is that if you're a teacher, like if you're a fireman or you're in the military, you're branded in some circles, not all circles, as a hero.
Right. You're providing public service, right. Which in fact you are.
Absolutely. And we look at ourselves as educators as sort of the last bastion of hope in a world gone mad. And what we don't realize is that we are perpetuating the madness.
Right. Exactly. In other words, the captains of industry and leaders of government set out to create an educational system that would maintain social order and increase profits. How? By teaching students just enough to serve industry, but not enough so that they could think for themselves. Questioning the socio-political order and communicating articulately were not part of the plan. Americans were to become drones in a government-subsidized country ruled by corporations. While Reagan-era neoconservatives were excoriating communism as a system in which government controls industry, they were promoting a system built on an even worse idea, one in which the industry controls the government. This was published 10 years ago, this book of mine.
Yeah.
Mind you, the development and implementation of K-12 concentration camps is not part of some giant conspiracy. Rather, it is the outcome of the way our educational system was created. Most of the people who originally developed the system believed they were doing the right thing, and they did not try to hide their plans or intentions. It was completely consistent with the perspective derived from religious organizations that the domination, cohesion, and vitality of society were inversely related to individualism. Permitting free inquiry and action were anathema to control by religious societies and also by corporate society. Today, the blueprint of education to serve corporations remains unchanged. Although the reasons behind the blueprint have been largely obscured by history, they are still known by many contemporary educators. As clinical psychologist Bruce Levine wrote in Common Sense Rebellion, quote, I once consulted with a teacher of an extremely bright 8-year-old boy labeled with oppositional defiant disorder. I suggested that perhaps the boy didn't have a disease, but was just bored. His teacher, a pleasant woman, agreed with me. However, she added, they told us at the state conference that our job is to get them ready for the work world, that the children have to get used to not being stimulated all the time, or they will lose their jobs in the real world.
The real world.
End quote. In other words, citizens who are capable of thinking for themselves cannot properly serve the corporations that run the country. The main point of this history lesson is simple, and you've heard me say it before, get used to swimming upstream. Most people do not want to think for themselves, or perhaps they actually think they are doing so, which is even more terrifying. In fact, they have only rarely been asked to think for themselves. A century of standardized education in support of business pushes society ever closer to corporate hegemony, and therefore, in the case of American-style capitalism, ever closer to exterminating the world's cultures and species. A fine recent example of standardization at the expense of thoughtful reflection is the federal No Child Left Behind Act, a bill strongly supported by Business Party 1 and Business Party 2, before being signed in January 2012 by a self-proclaimed business and later wartime president, George W. Bush. Okay, so that is the end of the long passage. It's pretty clear the two of us have been swimming up the proverbial stream for a long time. I would suggest that only dead fish are carried along by the stream's main current. And we do have a caller.
All right. And who
Dries, Dries from Philly.
All right, Dries.
What you got? Hello, hello.
Hey.
Welcome
hello,
back. Hello, hello, fellas. Thank you, thank you, thank you. Good to hear from you guys again. Good to be on the show once again. I never miss an episode. Thank you for all your hard work once again. I have a kind of a question and a comment first, but because it's what you're saying. And I just sat there and listened to your passage, guy, and it rings true and it hit home. I got on the what? Because I've had these conversations with a lot of my friends who happen to be in the educational field, and just getting their opinions and their weigh-ins on how, you know, how they look at the current state of affairs in the educational system. And a lot of them, they agree that it's pretty much a disaster. But when I ask them, when I follow up, you know, with the question asking them, you know, how can they help to remedy, you know, the current state, they seem to take the disciplinarian approach. It seems that they prefer the old, like, I guess the old Japanese adage, the nail that sticks up gets hammered down approach. So they just hammer all the children down and beat the creativity out of them, not physically, but pretty much mentally, because you just drone through every day with the same routine, and it turns the children off, and it kind of adds to that, you know, that air of disinterest in, you know, the conventional educational system. So now they made, they, as a result, they seem to have made it difficult, more difficult for themselves to get that buy-in to, you know, from the kids and maintain that connection that they, I guess they, maybe they once had. And so now they're frustrated, and it seems that the, you know, no matter what, they seem to, they seem to just go back and revert back to the disciplinarian approach, because they believe that this is the one method that is tried and true that works across the board. And furthermore, you know, as a parent, I find myself more than ever, and I'm going to share something personal with y'all. I'm always apologizing. I find myself apologizing to my son more than ever now. So I say about the past maybe 3-4 years, you know, once I started, you know, becoming more aware of what's going on around me. And I started having these conversations with him because he's at that age, you know, he's a preteen. And again, we're not going into too much detail now because I don't want to put him out there too much. But, I mean, we've had conversations around this, and my heart gets so heavy because I feel so helpless. I feel like I let him down because I should know better. And I should have, I don't know, I feel like as a parent, what do I do now? I'm in what you like to call, guy, and what you often allude to, Mike, is the parent trap. Mm-hmm. Because now I'm in this predicament, and I realize that, you know, day after day, and the more I learn, the more questions I have. And the more he learns, the more questions he has. And so he's looking to me, and we're having these conversations, and I'm like, I don't have all the answers. Cause I try to be as completely honest with him as possible. You know, I believe that when you become a parent, your life becomes an open book. That's just for me. I can't speak for other parents, but as a parent, my life is an open book to him. So we talk, I share my whole life with him, my whole life's experience, and everything that I learn, I try to share with him, just to help better equip him for what's coming. And it seems like no matter what I do, it's not going to be enough. It really isn't. And again, my heart is so heavy. It just keeps getting heavier and heavier with the stuff that I learn. But at the same time, I do appreciate people like you guys who are out there every day and day out, you know, keeping the conversation on the table. That's why I never miss a show. And I definitely am very appreciative of, you know, the work that you've done. But again, I just, when it comes to that topic, I just feel so helpless. I mean, it's as a parent, as a citizen, as a person that's walking around on this planet, I just feel helpless, to be honest. And I know I'm just venting, but I just wanted to get that out there. And I don't know. Again, I do appreciate everything you guys have done. So just keep on in the struggle, and I'll keep listening. I don't care how drastic things get, and how much you want to, you know, air the show. It doesn't matter. I'll still keep listening. But this is pretty much where I am mentally right now. Just in a state of confusion, and as well as going back and forth, roller coastering up and down the stages of grief. So that's all I have right now.
Thanks, Dre.
Yeah, no problem, guys. No problem. No problem, fellas.
Great point. You know, this is a predicament, and we're all born into captivity, as my friend Tim Bennett likes to say. And so, in addition to that, there's no escape.
No, and you know, I'm not a parent, so I can't really speak to that. But as a teacher, you know, I don't want to get to the point where I'm necessarily blaming teachers. I think teachers are complicit in some of the choices and actions in knowing what's going on and still participating on some level. But when you, at least from a high school level, there is an agenda that you absolutely have to get through. And when Dries brought up, you know, discipline, that's the only way you can get through the amount of information that is required for you to get through so these kids can jump through a particular hoop so they can graduate high school.
So they can write the 5-paragraph essay.
So they can do a bunch of stuff that, in, you know, long term is ridiculous. So it's one of those things. You know, you take all these classes about teaching theory, but when you come into a classroom and you have to, you know, get to X, Y, and Z in a particular amount of time, you do what works. And what works is sometimes heavy-handed because, you know, you want to keep your job because you need to hit these particular numbers. And that's why I don't do it anymore. I flipped in plenty of this stuff, stuff that I thought actually mattered in my teaching. But after a while, I'm like, I just got sick of pretending that I was caring about the other stuff.
Right.
And I couldn't do it anymore. And, you know, one of those who think they can.
Right, and that's the thing. You can sneak this stuff in.
Yeah.
But you have to sneak it in.
You have to sneak it in.
You know, ultimately, I was banned by my department head from teaching in my home department.
Yeah.
Because I was sneaking too much of this stuff in.
Right.
So I don't get to teach in that department anymore.
No.
That's the solution to the problem that I became. And so that was really helpful.
Right.
You know, I sneaked in enough stuff that ultimately I wasn't able to sneak anything in anymore.
Yeah. As far as having a conversation with, you know, someone who's a preteen, I can't, on some level, I can't even imagine.
Well, yeah, me too.
You know,
what
to say.
The kids have access to so much more information, more inundated indoctrination.
Right. We have another caller, Ray from Seattle. Are you there?
Yeah, I'm here. I want to ask Guy a question.
Go ahead.
Hey, if you haven't pissed off every climate scientist in the world, can you get some of them on? I'd rather hear more scientists on than more of the types of guests that you've had on. Like, for example, to hear Kevin Anderson from the Tyndall Center in England, or Kevin Trenberth, or any of the others.
Yeah, that's a good idea. It ain't going to happen.
Yeah.
We ask them, they're afraid of the truth, just like everybody else. They're afraid they're going to be exposed as a radical, which is what they would.
I think part
of. Well, right. We have had, I believe, one climate scientist on,
M. Jackson.
M. Jackson.
Glacier specialist.
Right.
I think the only reason she came on is because she wrote a book,
right?
And she was kind of cresting as far as her popularity was going. She was, you know, Bill McKibben wrote her foreword, and so she was kind of. And plus, she probably didn't know a hell of a lot about it, so we got a little lucky there and slipped her in.
Right. We have had a lot of people say yes, and then they look into a couple of the shows, they realize what we're doing here, and then they just disappear. They don't even say no.
Yeah.
They just vanish. This email worked for them a while ago, and now it doesn't work anymore. Nobody's answering.
Yeah. So we have had a lot of yeses from particular guests, but then when it comes to time for them to pick a date, they disappear. So, unfortunately, that's the nature of the beast with talking about things that nobody else wants to talk about.
Right. And I'll give an example, Jason Box, who has done quite a bit of public education.
Yeah.
And he's probably in the top three, along with Michael Mann and Catherine Hayhoe, in terms of getting the word out to the public. Here's a guy who left his job at Ohio State University because he was being censored, and he comes right out and says that.
Mm-hmm.
Like Camille Parmesan, who moved from Texas to Europe. Jason Box moved from Ohio to Europe so that he could be more radical, so that he could actually put out the kind of information that he was being prevented from putting out before by the institution. And I asked him to come on the show after his famous quote about if we lose even 1% of the methane from beneath the Arctic Sea, we're fucked.
Yeah.
Right. So he was quoted as saying that. I asked him to come on the show. He said, If you will admit that your straw bale house is making a difference, is helping combat climate change, then I will come on your show. But you seem hopeless to me. And I thought, well, yeah, because I prefer the term hope-free.
Yeah.
But I am hopeless.
Right.
Absolutely, and I love that, by the way, because hope is wishing for an outcome over which one has no agency.
Right.
It's wishing for something in the future that somebody else is going to take care of.
Yeah. I mean, it's not because people... We don't have people on because we think they're going to disagree with Guy. Everybody disagrees with Guy for the most part. They won't just come on and do it, though.
Everybody so far.
Right.
We're still looking for that one. Are you out there? Somebody.
All right, should we continue? Or?
Yeah, we might as well.
Okay, so we're talking. That's the context of today's program, which is cultural indoctrination. It goes on. Consider, for example, the United Nations Global Goals. The world's most ambitious social engineering project ever undertaken is being written into school curricula across the entire globe. The target? Contemporary youth. In September 2015, world leaders committed to the Global Goals for Sustainable Development. That's a funny phrase. These include 17 goals to achieve three extraordinary things in the next 15 years, including ending extreme poverty, fighting inequality and injustice, and fixing climate change.
Fixing.
With
tools. We can fix this.
I think I have a hammer back home. And every school in the world teaches, if every school in the world teaches children about these goals, the story goes, we will help them become the generation that changes the world, or that changed the world. As if development itself is, or ever could be, sustainable. As if the progress of civilization, which is characterized by extreme disparity in wealth, will help end extreme poverty. As if fighting inequality and injustice will magically result from the continuation of the most inequitable civilization devised so far. As if the heat engine of civilization can overcome an overheating planet. As Corey Morningstar writes at The Wrong Kind of Green, poverty pimping is as old as liberalism. Broken promises, likewise, under neoliberalism, this betrayal is orchestrated as humanitarian, as a dishonest broker, the UN plays a key role in this fraud, end quote. She goes on, promising relief from poverty, disease, and oppression, uber capitalists and psychopaths like Bill Gates and the Clintons joined the IMF and World Bank in supporting the UN Millennium Development Goals as contributing architects of the final solution, the Gates and Clinton Foundation lent to philanthropic veneer to free market brutality under the guise of promoting equality.
By the way, I just want to point out a little correction there. She did not write uber capitalists and psychopaths. She said sycophants.
There's no P there.
But it's kind of funny how you made that little interpretation of your
own. There is no P in that particular word. That's right.
Sorry about that. Pardon the interruption.
While this veneer might seem laughable to anyone paying attention, it holds considerable sway when repackaged by NGOs acting as fronts for Wall Street, like the humanitarian war charade and the free market Ponzi schemes over climate change, pimping poverty relief through mega development on indigenous territories requires expertise in controlling minds. The illusion of uber-capitalist philanthropy now unraveling in the aftermath of the Buffett 350 scandal was dealt another blow with the revelation of the Gates Foundation investments in the G4S, a company highly complicit in the Israeli military occupation of Palestine. While social engineering by the capitalist elite using private foundations is as old as tax loopholes mobilized free market multitudes is largely a social media phenomenon. As Michael Barker notes, most telling are the covert anti-democratic campaigns funded by the corporations like Microsoft. By manipulating media, Gates Foundation like Ford and Rockefeller undermines democracy worldwide. The philanthropic colonization of civil society is just one more means of their coercive social engineering.
So we go back more than 100 years, 120 years, to the Rockefeller Foundation, to Coverley, to even John Dewey, right? These people that culture props up as some sort of heroic figures for us.
Mm-hmm.
And it's pointed out that the people pulling the strings of industry are telling us one thing, and we're buying it, and what's really happening is not what we think is happening.
Right.
Or in some cases, we think it's happening, we just don't know what to do, so we just go along.
Yeah.
And we're headed down that same path with this United Nations document.
Right.
The acceleration into the abyss. That is uber capitalism.
Yeah.
That is the whole that underlies the entire series of predicaments we face.
Yeah. And the only thing that's changed in the last 150 years are only some of the names.
Right.
Not all the names.
Right.
And some of them.
And so, as Corey Morningstar pointed out a few weeks ago, we now have Rolling Stone complicit
right.
in getting the information out.
Yeah. We just have to be a little more clever today.
Right.
And some aspects. You know, a little more hip, a little more trendy, a little more pop culture-like.
But not all that much more.
No, no.
Because people want the narrative to continue.
Sure.
People, it's basically telling people what they want to hear.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean,
and dressing it up in a way that is palatable.
Yeah.
I mean, of course, we want to hear that we're improving the lives of everybody in the world. That those drones are killing the occasional person.
Right.
But the ultimate goal is freedom and democracy in the Middle East.
Right. And every 4 years or every 8 years, depending on who sticks around, we are given the choice of the lesser of two evils. And even those who are, you know, I would consider pretty radical in thought, they cannot get themselves to the point of resisting that game. Because
right.
at the end of the day, and I understand the choice of A versus B, and in some cases, if you get A in there, it's going to hurt a particular group of people, and if you get B in there, it's going to hurt a particular group of people. But at the end of the day, A and B, it doesn't matter. They're pushing this train forward.
Yeah.
And what is the point where you can't even, where you just say, can't even resist voting? That's the easiest thing in the world is probably resist.
Right. The twin cheeks of the corporate ass
yeah.
are neither one of those cheeks
yeah.
is going to help you, is going to help me. And it's not just because we're out here in rural New Mexico.
Right.
No, it's because the game is rigged. And let's admit that the game is rigged. And for those of you who have tenure out there in the educational industrial process, do something.
Anything.
You got tenure.
Yeah.
You do something beyond the five-paragraph essay. Make the five-paragraph essay about something that matters, for crying out loud.
Right.
Actually, force, and you will be forcing, force that 16-year-old to think.
Right.
Beyond the dominant paradigm.
Yeah, because maybe at the end of the day, the only thing we can hope for is that there will be a moment of clarity. And even if it's only a moment, well, that's more than most folks get.
That's right. And, of course, it will be shattering. It will be a shattering process for the people involved. Enlightenment is like that. Mm-hmm. It's a painful awakening. There's no good that comes of it. So, we sound like such a bummer.
We do. I'm starting to bum myself up.
Should we drink or should I?
I'm drinking water.
Should I go to the script?
Go to the script.
Okay. I should point out that the beat goes on, as we've been saying, and it's assisted by the teachers within the system, nearly none of whom encouraging questioning the system. We ask these minor questions within the system, but we never ask questions about the roots of the system itself. So consider the following example. I subscribe to Jay Hansen's America 2.0 email list. It succeeds his popular website, dieoff.org, which is still in operation. On May 22nd, 2016, Nathan John Hagans, known as Nate Hagans, launched one of his customary pieces of libel to the list. After making a fortune on Wall Street, Hagans now teaches a class called Reality 101 at the University of Minnesota.
I know.
You know, I want to spend the whole rest of the show on every sentence I read here. He disparages my work regularly, citing his colleagues who believe climate change will become a problem we'll need to address in a century or two. Citing his colleagues.
Yeah.
You know, it's it's this capitulation to authority instead of it to evidence that gets us into this kind of trouble that we're in right now.
Oh. Right? The university system we're talking about here.
Oh, right. Unimpaired by evidence and unaware that abrupt climate change is underway, Higgins regularly writes nonsense such as the following. A great many people in the blogosphere, including but not limited to Guy McPherson, go off on their own non-science-based fantasies. No one on this list, correct me if I'm wrong, is a trained climate scientist. The way humans work is we look at our in-group on what people think and believe strongly science is secondary to what our tribe believes. If we're a group of born-again Christians, we are unlikely to believe God will allow climate change to be due to humans. If we watch Fox News, we will have a built-in skepticism about climate change. If our group of closest internet experts say that climate change is a hoax, ditto. If we frequent Nature Bias Labs, we'll have a different opinion entirely. All of us, including me, perceive a virtual reality that is distinct from the physical truth. If we imagine switching in groups for a day and hearing or reading what those others hear or say, we might empathize with how Guy McPherson and Alexander Carpenter can both be utterly confident, diametrically opposed, and completely wrong. I have no idea who Alexander Carpenter is, by the way. Apparently he's almost the same as I am. My point to this long diatribe is that Higgins is actually paid to teach impressionable people that I'm an extremist. He uses a video from one of my presentations in his Reality 101 course, and I suspect he uses the subsequent discussion to paint me with the same brush of crazy my former colleagues use. Like them, I doubt if he has seen much of my work, perhaps none. I doubt he knows that I quote the work of others as the entire basis for my connected dots approach. This, my friends, is what passes for contemporary higher education.
Maybe she'd have you as a guest speaker to his class.
Wouldn't that be fun? You know, it's interesting because people proposed we bring him on the show because he does this Reality 101, and
yeah.
He's such a smart guy.
Right.
He puts on these presentations that are all about how we're going to fix these
right.
myriad predicaments in which we're embroiled.
Right.
As long as we don't touch the way the money works.
Right.
Because he's got a shit ton of it.
Oh, yeah.
And he doesn't want to mess with that.
Yeah, he could and he could save a lot of time if he just take his class to a mall and sit for 15 minutes. There's your Reality 101.
We're fine! Yes, indeed. That's all it would take.
Oh, my God, we're in a mall. I want a fresh mall.
Well, you know, it's interesting that, part of it surely is because that he is, his financial wealth allows him to separate himself from the reality that he calls Reality 101.
Oh, yeah, and he's got his own narrative, which is being challenged by you.
Right, and that narrative is coming from privileged white men
yeah.
in the global north,
right.
of which he's one.
Right.
So, but guess what? So was I.
Yeah. I know.
So was I, and so were you. And we managed to break out of that paradigm, break out of the mold,
right.
and see reality as something other than Reality 101.
Yeah, I mean, we're in the club. We get it. We got the manifesto. We know the fucking talking points.
Right.
But we also know they're full of shit. And we don't teach Reality 101 at a fucking university.
And if we did, it would have a lot more reality in it than the kind of nonsense.
Right. If we did, it would only be one class because they'd fire us.
Even if we had tenure.
Right. Even if we had tenure, they'd really figure out a way. Well, I mean.
What's it going to do?
It's interesting, and I don't know if people ask you this anymore, but once in a while I get this, and this is how long are you going to do this? And they think I'm going back to teaching.
Right.
So,
I don't get asked that.
I'm not. I don't much anymore, but I did for a couple years.
Uh-huh. So. People often recommend it to me.
Yeah.
That I should go back to teaching, and I point out to them that the chances of me being allowed to teach
right.
at any institution
yeah.
from kindergarten through
unless
whatever.
You personally own your own chartered
right.
school or
then
university.
Maybe I could get past my board of trustees and teach at my own
or your personal interview.
Right. I'd fail an interview with myself. So you're telling me civilization has adverse consequences?
Right.
Next.
Yeah. I don't think I trust myself.
All right. Well, next week's show, we get to do more of this chattering back and forth with each other.
That's right.
So
next week is just us again.
The 12 listeners have that to look forward to.
And by the way, two fantastic calls
yeah.
today. Really,
yes.
good call.
Absolutely. Thank you for those.
Yeah, really good call. So we really appreciate the calls. And I think both guys, you know, kind of build it out there and put it out there.
Yeah.
All you can ask.
Antonio and Reese. Yeah. And I suspect from the name of the first one, and I know based on the conversations I've had with the second one, these are not white men. So maybe we should listen for a while instead of talking for 58 of our 58 fucking minutes.
Right. Okay, well, that about wraps it up this week. Make sure to like our Facebook page, Nature Bats Last on Progressive Radio Network. You can join our Facebook group as well. It's Nature Bats Last on PRN.FM. Feel free to post questions you'd like us to address in the show. And please share the show widely so we can get our numbers back up and our self-esteem. You know, because shocking, white guys with low self-esteem. So we'll pull our way through this. Also, continue to follow Guy's blog at GuyMcPherson.com for further updates, essays, and speaking tours, and you can find my work on the Good Men Project. We'll see you on the radio next Tuesday afternoon, 3 p.m. Eastern, where it'll be just Guy and I. And if you've missed the show, make sure to find us in the archives at PRN.FM or at Stitcher.com and rate us on iTunes. Thanks again to our listeners and our callers and Afra Zinn for his music. Until next time, remember the dominant culture's been very clever, but in the end, nature bats.
Gonna get you, you betcha.